I'm Christopher Lydon with the young poet Jericho Brown, who wants to think of himself as the love child of T.S. Eliot and Langston Hughes. We're hearing the varieties, the lineages of poetry in our midst, in our time, on Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This is another in the series, Whose Words These Are, on the way to the Massachusetts Poetry Festival in October 09. Starting with the naive question, where poetry comes from and where it's going. Jericho Brown was born in Shreveport, Louisiana, grew up in New Orleans. Library daycare introduced him to Shelley's love poetry. The Black Church introduced him to call and response testimonies and poetic performance. The great girl singers of pop, like Diana Ross and Janis Joplin, showed him the power of voice and of the color orange, all of which he demonstrated for us at the Grolier Poetry Bookshop in Harvard Square. Jericho Brown, there must have been a poem or a poet that got you started, or that told you that's where you wanted to live your life.
Yeah, I think the first poem that really made an impact on me was by Percy Bysshe Shelley, and it's called Love's Philosophy, and it's still one of my favorite poems today.
Let's hear it.
Okay, I'll read that for you. Love's Philosophy. The fountains mingle with a river, and the rivers with the ocean, and the winds of heaven mix forever with a sweet emotion. Nothing in the world is single, and all things by a law divine in one another's being mingle. Why not I with thine? See the mountains kiss high heaven, and the waves clasp one another. No sister flower would be forgiven if it disdained its brother, and the sunlight clasps the earth, and the moonbeams kiss the sea. What is all this sweet work worth if thou kiss not me? That's one way of falling in love.
Right? Where were you? What were you doing when you read or heard that poem?
Oh, wow. When I read the poem, I was in the library. I was probably 10 years old. I was very lucky when I was growing up because my mother had trouble getting childcare. So what she'd do is drop us off at a library, which was around the corner from where we lived. Where was it? In Shreveport, Louisiana, where I was born and raised. I love to tell people I was raised in Shreveport and I grew up in New Orleans. It was around the corner from the grocery store. And I remember this because she would often go to the grocery store and leave my sister and me there. And by the time I was 11 years old, I had read most of John Updike's novels. Because I had accidentally come upon a novel and I saw the word breast, and I was like, oh, I gotta really get all of this in. So I don't know how much of it I understood, but I remember being really excited when the movie The Witches of Eastwick came out because I was like, oh, I read that. But this poem, when I would come across poems in that library, I would get I would read these poems by people like Shelley and be just enchanted by the rhythm and the rhyme, but also in particular by this very obvious, you know, this is a player at work here. There's somebody trying to get attention, and he doesn't want just like attention like, hello, how are you doing? He wants a kiss. And I really was taken by that very direct speaking to someone and using all of nature to show just how much I need this kiss. I thought that was really special. And I think that would prove useful to all of us who need a kiss right now.
So kiss and breast are the magic words. When did you start writing your own?
I don't remember not writing. I grew up in a very religious family, so it was always important that we participate in church and in events that called for me to be in front of an audience and say my little Easter speech. And often those speeches would be written by the kids themselves. Mm. And I was always enchanted by the pastor of my church. I went to a church where a civil rights leader, a man by the name of Harry Blake, was the pastor. And I was always just taken by his sermons. And I'm probably one of the few children who never went to sleep during a Sunday sermon, because I just thought it was amazing. And I would always be excited just to see what robe he had on. You know, African-American churches, particularly in the South, are so theatrical. Mm. And there was a lot of pomp and circumstance involved with going to church. And so I never thought about not writing. It was what I did very naturally. And it pleased my parents to see that I could, you know, go in a corner and spend a lot of time poring over a piece of paper. And, you know, there's an age where you actually want to do what your parents want you to do. So I've always done that. I don't think I realized that I was a poet or that I was completely interested in poetry until I had a fellowship that took me to Emory University in Atlanta when I was in undergraduate school. I went to college at Dillard University, and I went to Emory, and a man by the name of Rudolph Byrd, who is a scholar, had us doing work there. And I remember going to the library and coming upon the poems of a poet by the name of Essex Hemphill. And I was worn out by these poems. I never had felt spoken to in such a way. And I really wanted to do what he had done to me, to other people. I felt like somebody had like taken a belt and hit me across the back with it. And I wanted to hit other people in the back with a belt and make them like it too. So I think that was probably the moment that I really decided. And I had a long way before I manifested that excitement into a real life. This is going to be my everyday practice, because you don't really tell your parents, oh, I'm going to be a poet, at least not when I was growing up and when I was in school.
Do you have a fragment of your church oratory in your head?
Oh, wow. I don't know if I could remember anything from church exactly. What I do remember... I remember that there were Sundays where the youth would be required to do what was called devotion and open church up. And devotion always had what they would call an old 100. And you would have to line out the old 100. And what that means is you would sing part of this line or part of this hymn, and then the church would follow in a kind of call and response way the rest of the line. And so I was always called on to sing this hymn, which started, a charge to keep I have. And then as soon as I would say that, the church would say, a charge. And they would, you know, sing that entire thing. And I remember being really excited by that. Like, oh, these people will say whatever the hell I tell them to say. So I think I remember that very distinctly. And, you know, obviously there are a lot of, scriptures and verses from the Bible that I still remember and that are still with me. Even in the poems that I write today, those kinds of cadences that I remember hearing. And also, this is why it's so strange for me to give a poetry reading now. You know, I'm from a place where you knew when you were doing a good job. when people liked what you were doing, they would exclaim liking what you were doing while you were doing
it.
And you had to know exactly. You had to know exactly how to, you know, let that come in and keep going. Whereas now when you read poems, the room is stock silent and you don't know. I don't know if I'm failing or not here. So
we're trying to encourage you.
I appreciate that. So when I graduated from school, I was totally mixed. I had this English major that I had gotten because I knew I loved literature. And I had lied to my parents the entire time I was getting this major, because they would not allow me to be an English major unless I promised it was because I was going to law school. Well, law school was the last thing on my list of things to do. So once I got out of school, I was really mixed up because I didn't know how to go about following this inclination I had for writing. I had had creative writing classes, but not with the intensity that people have them now. And even thinking about entering an MFA program, no one made that suggestion to me at that time, not then at least. And so I started working in public relations and communications, and I got a job right out of school. I'm always very thankful to Mark Morial for this, because there was no reason why. I mean, I was just like 22 years old, and he hired me to do this really enormous job. Mayor Mark Morial, yeah. He hired me to do this really enormous job for New Orleans, where I was writing a weekly column for Louisiana Weekly, putting on press events, writing press releases, and writing his speeches for everything that he had to say. And he was kind of an amazing person to work with, because he would scare me to death, but he had a photographic memory. So I could show him something 5 minutes before he had to be on stage, and he had it all there. Mm. So he's a genius in that way. And the more I did that job, the better I got at it. But the more I realized that it wasn't necessarily since we're talking about church, it wasn't necessarily my calling, right? There was something in me that wanted to write poems, that wanted to do that thing that had been done to me by Essex Hemphill and Percy Bysshe Shelley and Claude McKay and Gwendolyn Brooks and so many of the other poets that I love so much.
Hmm. I'm dying to hear your own words in your own voice.
Oh, sure. I can do that. I have poems. I wrote some. This you'll like this then. Let's see. Many of the poems from my first book, Please, are persona poems that deal with what we think of as old school music. And I like reading these poems because people always ask me, how do you know those songs? But this is a poem in the voice of Janis Joplin. Hmm. Track 5, Summertime, as performed by Janis Joplin. God's got his eye on me, but I ain't a sparrow. I'm more like a lawnmower. No, a chainsaw. Anything that might mangle each manicured lawn in Port Arthur, a place I wouldn't return to if the mayor offered me every ounce of oil my daddy cans at the refinery. My voice, I mean, ain't sweet. Nothing nice about it. It won't fly, even with Jesus watching. I don't believe in Jesus. The Baxter boys climbed a tree just to throw persimmons at me. The good and perfect gifts from above hit like lightning, leave bruises. So I lied. I believe. But I don't think God likes me. The girls in the locker room slapped dirty pads across my face. They called me bloodhound, but I never bit back. I ain't a dog. Chainsaw, I say. My voice hacks at you. I bet I tear my throat. I try so hard to sound jagged. I get high and say one thing many times, like Willie Baker, who worked across the street. I saw some kids whip him with a belt while he repeated, please. School out, summertime, and the living lashed. Mama said I should be thankful that the town's worse to coloreds than they are to me, that I'd grow out of my acne. God must love Willie Baker, all that leather, and still a please that sounds like music. See, I wouldn't know a sparrow from a mockingbird. The band plays, I just belt out, please. This tune ain't half the blues. I should be thankful. I get high and moan like a lawnmower, so nobody notices. I'm such an ugly girl. I'm such an ugly girl. I try to sing like a man. Boys call boy. I turn my face to God. I pray. I wish I could pour oil on everything green in Port Arthur. Okay, I'll share another one then. This next poem is... The title comes from one of my favorite poems. It's a song by Minnie Riperton called Back Down Memory Lane. And a lot of people don't know who Minnie Riperton is anymore. She's she may be Mariah Carey's biggest influence, right? Because she had one of those voices that could do that screeching thing that you either love or Mariah Carey makes you want to turn the radio down, right? and obviously the most popular song by Minnie Riperton is "Loving You." That la 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 la. La 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 la, doo 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 doo, and then there's that high note that I'm not going to embarrass myself with, right? But this is Memory Lane, track 3. Back down, Memory Lane. Dangerous men park carefully, slanting oversized automobiles into the ditches that line 77th. It's Friday night in Shreveport. Checks have been cashed, bills folded and stashed into wallets and bra straps. Card tables, folding chairs, and every gold tooth in town crowd our grandmother's camelback shotgun house because gambling's illegal in Shreveport and she cuts only $2 a hand for every joker that slides into a queen. We don't know. Minnie Riperton's dead. Years now, buried with one breast to her name. School uniformed in a corner. We learn to listen to music over hollers through smoke. Her soprano comes across a photograph in giggles, but ends up crying, "Save me." We think we'd like that kind of love, sad and steeped in trumpets, though a block up the entire decade shoots for words to put in the dictionary. Crackhead, drive-by, loss. And gain. The bullet meant for a man named Money removes his baby sister's chin. Ask for horns in Shreveport, and sirens are on the way. We can't hear either. Grandmama calling for us to change the tape. No more slow songs. Keep us awake. These years before surgeons slice her in vain, and we drive away, our car stereos playing rhythm and blues.
What is it about singers, and girl singers in particular, as they're known?
Oh, wow. You mean divas, not just girl singers. For me, it's the divas. They're beautiful, right? And tragic and gorgeous, and you just want to like, and they're disgusting. Mm. They're awful people, huh? You know, I love that. I love that there's a certain kind of, there's a certain kind of vulnerability and confidence that go hand in hand with being Diana Ross, right? You know, every poet has his or her obsession, and that's definitely the obsession that runs through this book. And I try to use that obsession to say things about what I think of as history and culture. In this poem, for instance, thinking about the way in which many communities were destroyed by crack. And thinking about the music that was playing in the background when that destruction happened. Or thinking during Janis Joplin's time, thinking about what race was about in this nation. Or what it was like to be an outsider or an outcast in a community and to see all of these things going on around you, particularly in the South. So it's not just the singers. I think I use, or I hope to at least, use the singers as a vehicle for bigger and broader statements. And all the while, what I really hope to do more than anything, and I think what's most important to any poem, is the same thing that I was saying about Shelley. It's the music and the language and the rhythm. And, you know, not just that you're writing about singers, but that the poem itself comes across as song to the reader. That it seems as
as natural, you know, as a tree is to the ground, right? And I really, that's what I really want for my poems, and what I really look for when I'm reading poems. You know, I'm quick to put a book down if I feel like it's not doing that thing that is the natural thing that I want a poem to do, because I want it to speak to something that I think only a perfect manipulation of language can speak to. So I think that's the thing, to answer your question. I went a long way to answer that
you
question.
You said a lot, Jericho Brown.
I talk a lot sometimes.
Good. Yeah. Give us another one. All the better if it's about a forgive the expression, girl singer.
A girl singer, yeah, okay. I'll read the Diana Ross poem in this book since you like the girl singers. Track 4, Reflections, as performed by Diana Ross. I wanted to reflect the sun. I wore what glitters, smiled, left my eyes open, and on the ceiling of my mouth balanced a note as long as God allowed. My head tilted backwards, my arms stretched out and up. I kept praying, if the red sun rising makes a sound, let my voice be that sound. I could hear the sun sing in 1968. I learned the word assassin and watched cities burn. Got another number one, and somebody set Detroit on fire. That was power. White folks looking at me directly and going blind so they wouldn't have to see what in the world was burning black. Yeah, I probably should have mentioned before reading that poem that, you know, Reflections went to number 2 on the pop charts in 1968. And it's this love song. It's this I miss you song. And when you think about everything that's going on, in 1968, right? Like, how is it that people are buying a song that says, I love you and I miss you, right? And I'm really taken by that, I mean, I think poetry is this way too, right? That, you know, I was telling one of my students this the other day that, you know, poetry isn't, it's either a window through which we see the world, or a door through which we enter the world, right? And that there's something about that window view that shields us from the world, but there's something about that door where we have to deal with the world. And I think it's a good thing. I mean, I don't say that as a criticism at all. Like, I think that I think there have to be songs, you know, that deal with these political and social things that are going on in our time. And I think that about poems too. But I also think there can be poems that are just sweet and beautiful and about love. You know, I always think of myself more than anything as a love poet. I don't seem like it so far, huh? but I do feel that way. And those are the poems that I'm most taken by are love poems.
So now you must give us a love poem.
Oh, yeah, I better do that, right? Let's find a love poem. I'm sure there's one in here somewhere. Yeah, okay. Yeah, this is a love poem. I like this poem. It's full of love. I say the word love in it. Again, you are not as tired of the poem as I am of the memory. A returning toothache on either side of the mouth. An ingrown hair beneath the chin, simple itch, bruising scratch. And again I am bundled in Cousin Kenny's clothes from last school year, my hand held by my mother's. We walk as if the house behind us isn't warm enough for my feet. In the dark, we make a few blocks around the one-story neighborhood that I loved, though nothing I've written tells you this. I want to cut it out of me, because turns out it never mattered. Right now, my mother's asleep on my father's chest. His arm has landed in the same place around her most of 30 years. Give a man a minute. She's asleep, and I'm typing it all over again. Everywhere, a man is shifting a bit to make his woman comfortable in his arms. I should have told you this lines ago. We walked back to the house we ran from because my mother loves her husband and his hands, even if laid heavy against her. I know you don't want to believe that, but give a man a minute. We're not done. My father loves his wife and the shape of her body. Even if hunched in retreat, their son keeping up. I'm so sick of it. Another awful father scarring this page, too. A bruising scratch. We walked back through an open door. And why don't I mention he kissed my forehead before covering me on the couch that was my bed? Listen, and you can hear them in the next room, planning names for the youngest of us, then making love loud enough for the oldest to learn.
That's a more ambitious kind of love than I expected.
Thank you. You're a sweetheart. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And now the Proust questionnaire, so to speak. Our own random questions about all sorts of things. But place yourself within 2 or 3 degrees of separation from the tradition, however you define it.
Yeah, 2 or 3. I don't know about those degrees, but I'll say this. I always hope to be the love child of T.S. Eliot and Langston Hughes, that they abandoned and had my aunts Lucille Clifton and Louise Glick raise. And I would like to believe that when I got old enough, I went to a college where there was only one teacher and her name was Jean Valentine. How about that?
Does that help? You get the idea. So who lives in your neighborhood nowadays and who's the conversation with poetically?
Who lives in my... do you mean that metaphorically? Or
of course.
No, yeah. I'm really taken by the poems of the other Bunting Fellow who's here with me in Cambridge this year. Her name is Katie Peterson. She wrote a book called This One Tree. And, you know, I really love her poems. But I like a lot of poets. Don Lundy Martin is a poet that I'm very excited about. The poet James Allen Hall. His book is called Now You're the Enemy. The poet Sean Hill, Blood Ties and Brown Liquor. There's a young poet named Roger Reeves who actually doesn't have a book out yet. He recently won the Ruth Lilly Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation. I'm a fan of poetry, so there's nothing I won't try, right?
Who are the ancestors that you've got to live up to?
The ancestors I have to live up to, That's an interesting question. I guess that's probably where Langston Hughes comes in. I often think of, you know, when I write my poems and when I do many of the things I do all day every day, I wonder if he would be proud of those things. Are these the kinds of things that he would recommend or that he would patron in any way? Because he was a very important. His essay, The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain, really was freeing for me. And so I really do think of him as kind of my great-grandfather in poetry. I think he left a wonderful legacy, and that legacy is one that I aspire to every day of my life.
Amen. Jericho Brown, who do you think of as your fellow travelers in other arts?
In other arts.
Oh, architecture, music, painting,
there's an artist named Daniel Minter Oh my Jesus, he's like you're like, I mean, if okay, radio world out there, Daniel Minter, MINTER, just go to google.com and look at the images. That's all I'll say. Like, he's
done
amazing, right? And if I could do what he does with color and scope and and history and culture, and like, if I could do that in a poem, you know, I mean, I hope that my poems sound like what Daniel Minter's art looks like.
What's the talent you lack that you'd most love to have?
Singing. That's an easy one.
You've sung and you sing.
No, but I'm not, you know, my mother's family, they were singers. You know, these people, you know, if there was a song led in the church, they were the ones leading it. And I've always been a blender. That's what they call the people who you put way in the background. I've always been somebody who, you know, well, he might catch the note. So he might sing on key today. So
Favorite singers?
Oh, wow, you asked the worst question. That's not fair. Donny Hathaway. Lately, I've been listening to a lot of Jeffrey Osborne, a lot of Freddie Jackson. They're favorite singers of mine. Of course, you know, Aretha Franklin, who I mentioned earlier, Diana Ross. I think I like singers who seem to have something of a story attached to their singing. And by that, what I mean is not a biography, but a story. Like, there are people I listen to who, when I read their biography, I'm actually not at all surprised that they have had such full and big and tumultuous even lives, because they put that in their voices. And I was probably in love with Donny Hathaway way before I knew anything about his supposed insanity. So his daughter, Layla Hathaway, is also, I'm a pretty big fan of her.
What's the key note of your personality in your poems, do you think?
The key note, you know, I'll say this. My favorite color is orange.
You look good in orange.
Thank you. I'm wearing orange right now, aren't I? This should be a TV show. Why are we on the radio?
people can see on the radio.
Yeah, oh, good.
Yeah, better
good.
Pictures on the radio.
Yeah, good, good. I'm glad. I think what I try to do is I try to get that color out in all of my poems. You know, no matter how dour the poem is, there's a certain kind of life that I think that color has. There's a certain kind of yielding to joy and to life that I think that color has. And that's what I really hope for in my poems.
A word about your process. Do you write every day? Do you write mornings, evenings?
I wish I wrote every day. I've written almost every day since I've been here in Cambridge. So Cambridge is a Boston. I'm living in Jamaica Plain. It's been a good place for me to write, but I don't write every day. They say there are two kinds of writers, those who write every day and those who, you know, just write sometimes, but when they write, they're writing, and I feel like I'm the latter. Mm-hmm. So I don't write a lot. I do a lot of reading and a lot of thinking, and I probably do a lot of scribbling. I've dated people who were telling me I was writing all the time, but I didn't feel that way. But real write, like feeling like I'm writing poems, probably for Please, I always, I mean, and it's a bit of a joke, but it's almost true. I really feel like I wrote this book in a summer. You know, I feel like I sat down when it all came to me at the same time, and it needed to be, I don't know, it had a gestation period, I'll say that. And then when it was time for it to be born, when it was time for the poems to be born, they were born. So,
what's your motto?
Oh, what is my motto? I have a student named Kyle Martindale, and I'm going to mess this quote up, but I have it on my Facebook page. He says something like, the world is ugly, but it is our job to make it sexy. He's a good poet, too. He's going into the MFA program at San Diego State, so I'm really proud of him.
Jericho Brown, thank you.
Thank you so much
for the conversation.
I really appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Jericho Brown. Our Brown University interns Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern helped us get ready. Thanks to the Grolier Poetry Bookshop and the Massachusetts Poetry Festival for helping gather up the players. And thank you for listening, especially if you'll leave a comment or your own poem, or your favorite poem from somebody else at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden.